This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Country Crossing be in the paper tomorrow?
I don't know what the hell's going on at this point. I'm over it. Damn it.
I guess we should give our loyal listeners a little bit of indication as to what's going on. I'm Greg Phillips.
Fuck's sake.
That voice on the other end of the line is Nick Duke. We are here. We are the Hard Traveling Fanboys. We are bringing to you. Are we? I don't know. That's a great question.
Will you ever actually hear this? We don't know.
We don't know. We are attempting to bring to you for the third time this week.
No, and that's right. We are not trying to bring you a third episode this week. This is the third time we've tried to record this fucking podcast.
We're trying to bring you an episode of Off the Page, which is intended to be a part of X Month here at the Hard Traveling Fanboys. And what we are trying to do is offer you a review of the film X-Men: The Last Stand from 2006. In the process of this, we rewatched the film independently of one another, then did a live watch of the film while reviewing it on Tuesday, only for that file to be lost. So, here on this Thursday night, we attempted to do said review again, only for that file to again be lost. So here we are. Third time's a charm, right?
It better be. This movie is not worth this much trouble.
No. We have invested more time and effort into X... Well, effort's questionable, but we've invested more time into X-Men The Last Stand than one could argue its producers did. That's not fair. That was unfair of me to say. I take it back. A lot of people worked hard on this movie, I'm sure. But nonetheless, we're going to give it a shot, folks. We're not going to do a watch-along. We tried that. It failed. We're moving on. We're just going to give our overview of the film and our thoughts, our abbreviated thoughts on this movie. The reason we picked X-Men The Last Stand is we wanted to compare it to Dark Phoenix, which just came out, because both of these movies purport to be telling essentially the same story from different perspectives. Now, as we'll discuss, X-Men The Last Stand kind of doesn't tell that story, really. It sort of half-asses that story. The one thing about Dark Phoenix you can say is it does tell its story. It commits to one story that it wants to tell, and it tells that story. Mm. Whether it tells it effectively is up to individual perspective, but... X-Men The Last Stand has seemingly two major stories that it wants to tell. And in the process of trying to tell two distinct stories, one about a mutant cure that has been developed that is planned to be weaponized and distributed, and one about the return from the grave of Jean Grey, who was last seen at the end of X-Men 2, sacrificing herself for the sake of the team. And then later, when she comes back in this movie, she is possessed by the Phoenix side of her personality. And she has all these uncontrollable emotions and unlimited power. And so...
No. Power. What kind of power, Greg?
Incredible power! Ah! And it's the problem is you could tell one of these stories in an hour and 45 minutes, which is how long this movie is. So mm-hmm. It's not a long movie. You can't tell both of those stories in an hour and 45 minutes.
No, you cannot.
And particularly both of those stories with a litany of new characters that are introduced to us here that are basically given off-camera introductions. And we're just supposed to accept that Kitty Pride is an X-Man now, who we've never met before. Beast
was and now was isn't.
An X-Man, was and now isn't an X-Man, and apparently was an X-Man before we ever met the X-Men.
Yes.
So we're supposed to accept that Magneto now has random followers that don't have names. We're supposed to accept that
Mystique has been captured off screen.
Yes, Mystique is captured off screen. The there's just a lot going on that we're expected to accept going in here. We also don't know the amount of time that has passed after Jean's death. We know that Scott is mourning it, and in his own way, he's really just crestfallen. He can't handle it anymore. He's not behaving as the leader of the X-Men. He's behaving as a grieving lover, essentially, that just wants Jean back. And you know, the team is in shambles. It's pretty much just Storm and Wolverine that are left. And Rogue is still there, of course, but she's part of a younger group of kids that are not really ready for the big time, along with Iceman, Colossus, and the aforementioned Kitty Pryde. And it's kind of a little bit of a crash course, Nick, in X-Men here at the beginning of this movie and throughout this movie, where there's a lot of stuff thrown at us. Some of it works, and we'll talk about that a little bit, but some of this that we're given here works very, very well, in fact, but a lot of it misses the mark and perhaps wouldn't miss the mark as badly if we had some sort of connection or understanding of these characters and why they're here.
Absolutely. I mean, there are scenes that are meant to be emotionally affecting, such as, I know Beast has a key scene where he meets a young child who is the reason the cure exists, and we see Kelsey Grammer playing Beast and his blue fur begin to roll away as his normal human form is restored, and that would just be so much more effective if we had ever met this character before. There are other examples of this. New villains such as the Juggernaut or Jamie Madrox, the Multiple Man, who each barely have any lines in the film and have no real character to speak of and just kind of shrug their shoulders and go along with whatever Magneto says. Yes. Kitty Pryde, who has joined the X-Men, developed relationships with the X-Men, and they pick up this movie expecting us to just be on board with this new love triangle that seemingly has been forming for months and we just didn't get to see any of it. It is a film that is very... It is very convinced that you are just going to accept anything it puts on screen. And perhaps after X2, you know, that was not that insane of a point of view. Sadly, the execution of this squanders whatever goodwill X2 had built up.
Yeah, when X2 ended, at that time, I considered it to be perhaps the greatest superhero movie I had ever seen. And when
it has to be like a two-horse race. Like, it had to be like that and what, Spider-Man 2 at the time?
Spider-Man 2 hadn't even come out yet.
Is that? Yeah. No, yeah, it had, hadn't it?
No. Spider-Man 2 was 04. X2 was 03.
Oh, that's right. I'm thinking this in Spider-Man 2. Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
So to that point, I mean, it was that, and it was like Superman 2 and Batman that were in that race for me. And it had the edge, I think. And I remember telling everybody, because they teased the Phoenix in that movie. Jean's sacrifice was a big moment at the end of that movie. And I knew it was coming. I knew the Phoenix saga was coming. And I remember telling everybody, this is going to be the greatest movie of all time. It's going to be the greatest superhero epic of all time. And then it wasn't. It wasn't even close to that. And that's where the big disappointment comes in. The story to tell in this movie was the return of Jean Grey, the Phoenix. They had teased it. They had shown her turning into the Phoenix. That's what people wanted to see. And they muddied it for whatever reason with the Cure subplot. And then they also threw in Magneto as the big bad villain of this one again, when he had been that in the first two movies, whether it was revealed at the end of X2 that he was, you know, ultimately manipulating everybody, or whether it was being the entirety of X-Men, the first movie, as the villain. I think we were kind of done with Magneto as the villain. We had explored that. It was time to move on. But they opted not to do that. Now, who's they? Well, we got to tell this story, Nick, for the third freaking time this week.
Yes.
But Bryan Singer, who directed the first two X-Men movies, yes, was going to come back and do X-Men 3.
Yeah, he was.
Instead, Instead, Nick, he moved on to do another movie called Superman Returns.
Yes, he did.
And when he did that, it opened the door, or it opened the directorial seat up. Then Fox went out and hired Matthew Vaughn, who would later go on to direct X-Men First Class. However, Matthew Vaughn backed out of the project due to creative differences. That left another opening, and rather than wait for Bryan Singer to complete Superman Returns, while working with, by the way, James Marsden, who plays Cyclops, who, by the way, is an essential part of the Phoenix story. So, James Marsden's time is taken up working on Superman Returns. Can't do X-Men The Last Stand very much. He's only in this movie for about, what do we determine, Nick? 25 minutes? And
only two scenes of that. I mean,
yeah, he only gets
total screen time is probably less than 4 minutes, I would say.
Less than 4 minutes of screen time. And even, you know, maybe four lines of dialogue. And so rather than wait, they decide they have to make this movie. They have to include the Phoenix because they teased it in the last movie. And they have to do this story without Cyclops. So they kill him off. So they're just in a lot of problems here. So who do they go and they get? Well, they say, we're not going to wait for Singer. We're going to go out. We're going to get Rush Hour director Brett Ratner to come in and pick up the pieces. Now, ha ha ha, Brett Ratner's done a lot of shitty movies. He's done a lot of shitty things in his existence, I'm sure. But the guy's at least a competent
film director. Not as many shitty things as Bryan Singer, apparently.
Right. He is at least a competent film director. He knows how to put together scenes and make a movie that is watchable at the very least. So not the worst decision in the world. But ultimately, this was a movie that was hamstrung by the fact that they have an hour and 45-minute runtime, and they're trying to tell two stories that should have been their own movie. You pointed out the last time we attempted to record this podcast, Nick, that X2 is a very kind of personal, low stakes, because there's massive stakes in that movie with regards to the mutant population.
But the scope isn't very high. I mean, it's kind of like this – the threat there from Stryker is supposed to be covert. You know,
yes.
Other than the opening scene with Nightcrawler attacking the White House, which is obviously, you know, very public and very epic in scope, the rest of the film is kind of telling this more private, personal story about, like, the X-Men and these internal threats they are facing, and, like, the larger community, the larger populace is largely unaware of these events going on. These are events that are intricately focused on the mutant community. This movie, however, Last Stand, is very obsessed with telling a epic, country-altering story. And if you didn't know it was going to alter the country, trust me, the president in this movie will tell you over and over again how high the stakes are here.
I feel like writer Simon Kinberg and or director Brett Ratner watched X2 and fell in love with that opening scene with Nightcrawler in the White House, but they didn't like it because of Nightcrawler. They liked it because of the overwhelming performance of the president.
Which isn't even the same president, by the way.
Good Lord. A lot's changed in the world of X-Men between X2 and X3. Just a disjointed movie here. There are elements of each story that work. I mean, I think there's a good movie in The Cure in exploring the ramifications of a cure on someone like Rogue or Beast, who, you know, would give anything to not have their mutations. They view their mutations as a curse, even Nightcrawler. Or someone like Storm, who is very adamant that there is nothing for them to apologize for. There is nothing that they need to be cured of. They're perfect the way they are. Or someone like Magneto, who views it as an affront to him, that even when we even suggest the idea of a cure. So there's a story to be told there, and to explore characters like, you know, we see in the beginning of this movie, actually a good scene involving Warren Worthington as a child, where he's trying to cut his wings off because he's afraid of being an embarrassment to his dad. And it's a great, powerful scene. Unfortunately, the rest of the scenes involving Warren Worthington are either laughably bad CGI or simply unwashably boring.
To be fair, there are only, I think, like three more. I mean, it's a movie that is trying to introduce so many new characters and tell, you know, two different stories at the same time that nobody really gets a ton of screen time in this movie. It has a massive ensemble, and unlike other more modern ensemble superhero films, it doesn't do a very good job of juggling that. you know, a lot of them in game, for example, which is, again, it's an unfair comparison because we've talked about the epic accomplishment that is. Whereas some of these more recent ensembles, everybody gets a moment. I feel like in this movie, virtually no one gets a moment. Bobby Drake, for example, just stands there and watches as Pyro blows up a building and does nothing about it.
Does nothing.
Kitty Pryde kind of gets a moment, I guess, depending on the effectiveness for it, you know, how effective it is for you with the Juggernaut thing.
Outsmarts the Juggernaut, yeah.
Storm but doesn't again, really get a but moment. Again,
did anybody really want Kitty Pryde to have a moment in this movie? Because
I did.
We had no introduction to her. We had no reason to care about Kitty Pryde versus Rogue or any of these other characters. Rogue doesn't get anything to do in the movie except go in to take the cure.
Right.
And Storm gets a couple of little moments here and there, but nothing major. You know, she gets the thing of, like, making a stand and becoming the new leader, but, like, not... Again, not given much to do. There's not much time for anybody to do anything. This movie doesn't have any time to breathe. And we talked about with Dark Phoenix how they focus on that one story for the entire runtime, and it, at times it kind of grinds to a halt in terms of pacing. This is the exact opposite problem, where they're trying to do too much. And as a result, nothing gets time to breathe. There are moments of greatness here and there. Any scene involving Hugh Jackman is awesome for the most part. He and Famke Janssen have insane chemistry.
Absolutely. It just occurred to me while we were talking about like nobody getting a moment. I think this has probably the worst action of any of the at least from Wolverine's perspective, the worst action of the three. Not really that dynamic action sequence like we saw in the first two where he gets to let loose. So
yeah, the scene in the woods is probably the only time that we get to see Wolverine really let loose in this movie, and all of his best moments are just kind of emotional things, like the big climax at the end, the sacrifice of the Phoenix.
His scene with Rogue, when Rogue is considering leaving the school, that's quite good.
Yeah, the scene in the medical bay with Jean. And or the one that we haven't even talked about on either of our last times very much was the scene with Charles, Jean, and Wolverine when they're in the medical bay. Mm-hmm. And Wolverine is confronting Charles over the fact that he put these mental blocks in Jean's mind. And Charles, in a rare bit of Patrick Stewart's Xavier kind of dropping his kindly demeanor, is like, "I'm not going to be judged here, least of all by you." Kind of a bit of bitchiness from Charles. And I enjoyed seeing he and Logan kind of go at each other there. And then Phoenix playing off of that by putting the idea in Logan's head that maybe Xavier did the same thing to him. But again, that's something they could have explored if the whole movie was dedicated to the Phoenix story. But unfortunately, they never follow up on that scene. There's never any moment of Logan sitting there and doubting whether the professor had done something like that to him. So there's just a lot of missed opportunities here. Juggernaut is in this movie apparently solely to deliver a line from an internet meme that was popular at the time and has not aged particularly well.
Yes, you see, back in the time around 2005, 2006, there was a popular series of internet videos back in the, not the infancy of YouTube, but still the early popularity of it, in which a group of African-American gentlemen would overdub the voices for X-Men the Animated Series in a stereotypically over-the-top African-American manner of speaking. And it was very funny at the time. And why? I don't know. I can't explain it to you. Was it even funny at the time? Who knows?
Great question. The other reason that Juggernaut exists is to wear an absolutely ludicrous aluminum foil helmet. It just looks awful, Nick. This is the one of the worst superhero costumes I've ever seen in a movie. It is that bad. He looks nothing like the Juggernaut. He looks like an idiot, and walking around with this stupid cheap ass helmet. It looks so cheap. This is a movie where they make Kelsey Grammer, to their credit, look exactly like Beast did in the animated series, and yet they give us a Juggernaut that looks like he's in a damn, I don't even know, like he's on the set of Alex Jones's show or something with his stupid tinfoil helmet. So, like, what is how does this costume exist alongside this costume and the CGI on Angel exists in a movie that also has, you know, great looking costumes for people like Wolverine and Storm and some of the other X-Men, or great effects in the form of Magneto crushing the convoy and stuff like that. Mystique looks awesome in this movie. But then you have the freaking Juggernaut, the first time we ever see him in live action, and that's what we get.
It's not ideal. It is definitely less than ideal. But there are other characters in here. I mean, the Multiple Man, Jamie Madrox, doesn't really get a ton to do.
Yep. It's two lines, I think you said, the entire movie.
Colossus, I mean, he's in the opening danger room scene.
Yes.
Gets one line in the middle of the film, and then is in the closing action sequence, and that is his entire contribution.
And Daniel Cudmore's Colossus, let's just say he ain't the Colossus we all know and love.
No.
He walks by at one point, and somebody asks him a question. He's like, yeah, he cut out about an hour ago. It's like, what? Yeah,
and you would think, like, hey, they're introducing Kitty Pryde here. That's a natural, it'll be Colossus and Kitty, right? No, because they don't have enough time to do anything with Colossus.
Apparently, Daniel Cudmore either couldn't or they didn't tell him to do a Russian accent for Colossus. So instead, we get a.
That has to be direction, right? Like, he was
Colossus
told not
by
to.
By way of Jersey, yeah. But why would they tell him not to? What would be the disadvantage of him having a Russian accent?
Who freaking
anyway,
knows?
So there's a lot of weird stuff going on in this film. Weird, wild stuff. Johnny Carson had the guests on there.
Oh, that was Dana Carvey as Johnny Carson.
Yes, pretty much any impersonation I do of a celebrity that was popular in or before the late 1990s is going to be Dana Carvey's impersonation of said celebrity.
Jimmy Stewart, George Bush.
Do it again, whore. Yeah. Now look at it. Yeah. We're getting a little bluer than I intended. The
Blue Chew, you say?
Yes. I'm the Juggernaut, bitch.
There it is.
Oh. I just realized we forgot to explain the line that he was delivering. We did the setup for it, never delivered it.
The podcasts are running together at this point. I mean, like, I honestly don't know what I've said on this podcast versus others. So this will be the worst episode of the show in history.
Which is saying a lot.
Yeah, I know.
It covers a shitload of ground.
I know.
But nonetheless, I guess we should get to a couple other things.
Why?
What are some of the things that we talked about the first time that I... My problems with Magneto. Yeah. All right. This is the big one, I guess, that I need to get off my chest because I was so fired up about it. I don't think it's possible, folks, for me to regain the passion that I had when we first talked about it, or even the passion I was building up the second time. But essentially, Magneto, played here by the wonderful Sir Ian McKellen. We all love Ian McKellen. He's great, wonderful actor, wonderful job as Magneto in the first two X-Men movies. So this movie, though, presents a version of Magneto that is just so off base to me, just so out of left field to me. Yes, he's evil in these movies. Yes, he's been more traditionally villainous in the first two X-Men movies than I maybe like my Magneto. But I don't remember him ever being to this point as he is in X-Men 3. In the course of this movie, his longtime companion, implied lover, Mystique.
I thought you were going to say Charles Xavier.
We'll get to that. That too. We'll get to that. Mystique is shot with the cure and turned into a, quote, normal human. And when this happens, and by the way, she does this to save Magneto's life. She jumps in front of the bullet.
Not to save his life, to save his powers.
His powers, right. She jumps in front of the... Well, he's so old, Nick, he's probably going to die instantly when he loses his powers anyway. Well, not instantly, clearly, as we see at the end of the movie. But for all they know, when he gets shot with it, for all they know, he could instantly die because my understanding is that this Magneto is 178 years old, which means that he was already an old man during the Holocaust, but let's just ignore that for the sake of the joke. Mystique jumps in front of it. She takes the bullet, and she falls down, and she turns into her normal Rebecca Romijn Stamos self. She was still a Stamos at the time, people, before you tweet me.
At JR's BBQ.
That's right, at JR's BBQ. And good for John Stamos. And good for Rebecca Romijn. God. Match made in heaven.
Definitely.
And she's quite lovely. And Magneto does get a one great line off where he's like, she was so beautiful before. But this happens, and Magneto's reaction is not, you know, hey, let's help her out, or even, hey, at least I should get her some help and try to find a cure for the cure, find a way to reverse these effects. No, naturally, this version of Magneto's reaction is to turn his back on her, completely ignore her, and leave her for dead.
Yes. Yes, she deserves to die, and I hope,
and she burns in hell because she's not a mutant. That is right. Not Magneto to me. So, fast forward to the scene when Charles and Magneto go and they revisit the Jean Grey's household home where the Phoenix is laying out and trying to sort of plot her next move, I guess. And they go in there, and of course Magneto instantly tries to convince her that Charles is out to get her. This creates a conflict between Phoenix and Charles, where Magneto tries to get Phoenix to stop, admittedly. He says, Jean, no! And instead, Jean vaporizes Charles Xavier, who looks at the camera, smiles, and farts as he dies.
Yes.
As we all
do, by the way.
And gets snapped away, pretty much, with the same effect that we see in Infinity War with Thanos, where he's vaporized. And Magneto watches this whole thing happen. He's sitting there, helpless and feeble, watching his lifelong best friend, the man that he's quarreled with, but they've always had a respect and a love for one another. And he watches this man get vaporized by Jean Grey, and his reaction is not anger at Phoenix. His reaction is not even sadness or grief. His reaction is to instantly pick the Phoenix up and start manipulating her, mm-hmm. and try to get her to safety, to manipulate her onto his side. Then, later in the film, there is one line where Pyro, another character that has gone through inexplicable changes off screen, because Pyro has gone from a conflicted Xavier student who joins the side of Magneto to now telling Magneto, I wish you had given me the chance, I'd have killed Xavier if I had the opportunity. And Magneto stops him and says, Charles Xavier has done more for mutant kind than you could ever imagine. My one regret is that he had to perish for our dream to continue. And that's the only line we get in the entire movie where he even acknowledges that Charles is dead. And that's bullshit, because the relationship between Magneto and Xavier is one of the key linchpins of the X-Men universe that everything hinges on. And not just the comic book universe. That's going to the movies themselves. The movies had been built on this relationship between Charles and Eric, where Charles kept thinking he could convince Eric to his side, and vice versa. And here you see an Eric that is mostly unconcerned with that. But it gets even worse, folks, because then comes the big climactic action scene at the end of the movie. Oh, but wait, before I get there, then there's the scene where Jean is showing off her Phoenix powers and threatens Magneto with the cure, and he's terrified and begging off like Ric Flair during a Sting comeback, just raising his hands.
Hulk Hogan comeback, whichever.
Going, oh no, oh God no, essentially. And again, I didn't like that, because there's an alternate scene that should have been in the place of it, where instead he's concerned about the fate of his followers, that she's threatening his followers with the cure. Anyway, the climactic action scene in the movie, Magneto and all of his followers, we're talking thousands seemingly of mutants, are descending upon Worthington Labs to try to take out this kid that is the source of the cure. And before they go in there, Magneto takes his like most trusted soldiers and stops them and says, in chess, the pawns go first, and watches as all of these hundreds of mutants go down to fight the soldiers, and they get shot with the cure. Like, all of them get bombarded with the cure, which some of them are flying mutants, some of them are mutants that stick to walls, and these guys are falling to their deaths. They're literally being slaughtered, mutants being slaughtered wholesale, and Magneto doesn't give a damn. He smugly looks to his left and tells Pyro, "And that's why the pawns go first." Completely out of character for Magneto, who would never... His whole deal is not for power or for his own status. His deal is to fight for mutant rights, to fight for his fellow mutant. And in this case, in the entire movie, he shows zero regard for his fellow mutants. He only shows regard for himself. And that is a complete misread of the character of Eric Lynch here. There are villains in X-Men that are like that. Your Mr. Sinisters, your Apocalypses, but that's not Magneto. And it really pissed me off. Much more than it pissed me off that Juggernaut was limited to just being a thug. It much more pissed me off that Magneto is relegated to being a one-note villain in this movie, in my opinion.
Yeah, definitely not the most nuanced Magneto that we've seen in really any of the films. That's been one constant, is that even in the lesser Apocalypse or Dark Phoenix of the new series, Magneto has been good in pretty much every movie. So this is arguably, I don't even know if it's arguable, the worst Magneto that we've seen thus far, which is sad because it would be he and McKellen get to do it one more time briefly in Days of Future Past, but this is a damn travesty, I would say.
It's a damn shame.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, to sort of summarize my thoughts on the movie, in all honesty, there is good stuff to be found here. It should have been called X3 instead of The Last Stand. But you look at all the great performances that are in this movie. Famke Janssen, Hugh Jackman, James Marsden when he's there, Patrick Stewart, Kelsey Grammer, even Rebecca Romijn Stamos, who I did not give enough credit for her acting in this one. I think she's actually really good while she's here. She hits the line, "I don't answer to my slave name," which I can see some cringing at, but I actually thought was an effective line. And they're all great in this. But then you get two stupid doo-doo shit dumpster fire scenes about the president getting a status report on the cure, or the Worthingtons being boring and useless, doing boring rich person things.
It is remarkable to me how much you hate the Warringtons, considering how little they're in the movie.
Yes. Well, any of this stuff...
The damn president is in the movie more than the Warringtons.
Any of this stuff where it's old white guys in the movie talking about the cure, it's boring as shit, it's uninteresting, and I don't care. I don't want it. I don't give a doo-doo about it. I don't think the audience gives a doo-doo about it. I don't need to hear the president go, "God help us all," anymore. I don't need any of it. I don't need Angel doing his stupid 1940s Superman pose as he stretches his wings out. It looks like crap, it looks stupid, and I hate it. Now, with all that being said, there are enough good things here, including one area doing a direct comparison to these two movies. I think Dark Phoenix tells the Dark Phoenix story certainly much better, does a much better job of focusing on Jean and making it her movie. However, Last Stand kind of sticks the landing better than Dark Phoenix does. The sacrifice in this is great. It's one of my favorite scenes in all the X-Men movies, when Wolverine has to, against his better judgment, plunge the claws into Jean and kill her. And it sets up one of the better X-Men outings, which is the Wolverine from James Mangold.
I have been sitting here for the last two times we've watched this movie and done this podcast, trying to recall, where have I seen this president before? I know he looks so damn familiar. This will be lost on you, because one of the inherent character flaws about you, Greg, is that you have a hatred for the classic 90s kids-focused sports comedies that so many are fond of. The president in this film is Gerald Duxworth from the Mighty Ducks.
Now wait just a minute here. The film is called The Mighty Ducks,
yes,
right? And it's about a hockey team called the Mighty Ducks, right?
Yes.
Tell me that this Gerald Duxworth man is the owner of the Mighty Ducks and that he named the team the Mighty Ducks after himself.
Pretty much, yeah.
That's fantastic. That's right out of comic books.
He's a lawyer who owns a law firm, and his star up-and-coming hot lawyer, played by Emilio Estevez, gets a DUI, and it gets into a very public altercation with a police officer, and they are ordered to he's ordered to do community service, and as a means of trying to rehabilitate both his image and the image of the firm, his boss Gerald Duxworth decides to sponsor a local hockey team that the lawyer, played by Emilio Estevez, will then coach, seeing as how he is a former college hockey player whose hockey career was cut tragically short due to injury.
And that sounds a little bit like, not the same, but it shares characteristics with Happy Gilmore.
It's got some similarities, so yeah. And so Gerald Duxworth and all the team names in the league are bird-themed for whatever reason, and so he picks the Ducks.
Well, listen to this, because in comic books, as we've talked about before on occasion, everybody that starts a company just names it after whatever their name is.
Yeah, and then they just come up with a word to go after it. Industries, yeah, like consolidated.
Industries,
technology,
technologies. Yep. Enterprises.
Enterprises, yeah. Corp.
You know? So in this case, we have Worthington Laboratories and Worthington Enterprises, I think. Or Industries, sorry. So, anyway, this the sacrifice scene I did want to talk about being amazing. Great work from Famke Janssen and great work from Hugh Jackman. And it sets up the Wolverine. Wonderful. Unfortunately, most of the other stuff here, they instantly counteract their own damn stakes by having Magneto, who was rendered powerless at the end of the movie. We see him at the very end, and he's starting to regain his powers already.
That is certainly the implication, yeah. You get Charles Xavier, who has creepily body-swapped into the body of this comatose guy that they set up earlier in the film just for that purpose, to have him have his consciousness transferred over. So really, like, all these things, other than the death of Jean Grey, none of these things that they fight for throughout the movie ultimately matter.
No.
Hank McCoy has this deep falling out with the government and leaves because of his own personal convictions. And then the end of the film, he's right back with the government.
Right back with the government as a UN representative.
Yep.
Yeah, which, again, I can't get into all the details of it because I'm running out of patience, but the deleted scenes in this movie were almost all better than the ones that actually made the film. Including one where Hank stays behind and helps restart the school with Storm. Wolverine goes...
God, this is... I'm sorry. I'm actually... The movie has been playing the entire time, and I hate to turn this into a live watch, but I'm currently watching the climactic action sequence, or the beginning of this action sequence, where Magneto is picking up the Golden Gate Bridge, and it is one of the worst. I mean, it looks terrible. So fake.
Even his constipation face doesn't look good in this one. So the deleted scene that should have been the end of the movie is Wolverine goes back home to Canada. He's guilt-ridden. He's depressed. And he goes back to the very same bar where we first encounter him at the beginning of the first X-Men movie. And the bartender who was there in that movie is still there. And he confronts him, and he just orders a drink. And the guy says, "Going home?" And he says something like that. And it looks like this is a defeated man. And that's who we meet at the beginning of the Wolverine all those years later. Is this defeated man that's been living in the Canadian wilderness for the better part of a decade. But still haunted by what he does to Jean in this movie. So there's good things to be had here. It's just it needed more time to breathe. They needed to focus on one plot and tell one story, and it probably could have been effective. But as it is, there's some really strong performances, some good scenes, wasted and surrounded by crap. So
yeah, for me, it's a bad movie that isn't quite as bad as I remember it being.
I would agree with that.
How harsh we've been on it here to this point.
The problem for me is I agree that it's not as bad a movie as its reputation is. However, it's also when it comes to, like, there's not a lot of these bad comic movies that inspire this much anger in me, Nick, as you know.
Right.
We've watched some bad movies on here, and I don't know that I've ever felt, other than Green Lantern, this visceral... And even with Green Lantern,
it's not anger, and it's just, like, disappointment. It's like, you know, this, you've moved past the denial and into the anger phase, and
this is
Green
the
Lantern,
anger.
We haven't.
Yeah. And I'm more forgiving even of Green Lantern than I am of this, because I feel like this had – Green Lantern had a tougher job ahead of it, I think. This was a layup of a movie, and it as it stands, it's
God,
just
– God, the wire work in this. It is so it bad.
This is a below average but not terrible movie, arguably.
Right.
But this should have been a great movie, and at least could have been a good movie with just a little bit of tinkering. And it's just a huge missed opportunity, and it frustrates me to this day, man. I hadn't seen this movie in a long time before the 75 times I've apparently watched it this week. But it just brought back all this disappointment and anger about the missteps in this one. Because there is genuinely good stuff here. And I don't want to imply otherwise that this movie is some dumpster fire, but it should have been, you know, Dolph Ziggler's been doing these "it should have been me" promos. This should have been good.
It should have been. All right, so I guess the ultimate question that we came here to settle is not whether or not this movie is good, but is it better than Dark Phoenix? Is Dark Phoenix better than this?
I already know one listener that is going to be very frustrated by this answer from me, Nick, but it's kind of a push, and here's what I mean by that. They are not remotely the same movie, even though they're purportedly telling similar stories.
Right.
They each have flaws that are almost the exact opposite of one another's flaws.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely.
So, whereas one movie, Last Stand, is...
Now that Beast has kind of gotten out of the suit, I'm sorry. Now that he's kind of gotten out of the suit and let his hair down a little bit, he's got kind of a Kurt Russell type quaff going on now with his hair.
Sure, yeah.
Help us. There it is. There's Ducksworth, President Ducksworth saying, "God help us all."
Put the Doomsday Clock on the DEFCON floor.
That would have been better. We should have gotten that guy. In every movie that needs a president from now until the end of eternity, cast that guy.
Would you replicate the Watchmen movie with his makeup falling off of his face?
Every cinematic president is the Watchman Richard Nixon from now until the end of time.
With the prosthetic nose.
When you're getting ready to make "The Funeral Home Has Fallen" with Gerard Butler and a geriatric president, get the guy from Watchmen.
I can't believe they made another one of those. Angel Has Fallen. They might be good for all I know. I've never seen them, but Lord. Anyway, we're not here to talk about Gerard Butler.
You were comparing to, yeah. Sorry, you're the push.
The Last Stand has too much going on, has not enough commitment to its characters, and has, of course, some laughably bad CGI wire work and other things along the way. Dark Phoenix is glacially paced at times, and arguably takes too much time with some of its storytelling techniques, and doesn't give enough, and also has a horrifically bad villain in the form of these alien creatures, the asparagus people. They're just not interesting villains. A terrible performance from Jessica Chastain, who is not given much to do in this movie. So they're kind of opposite films in some ways, but they equal out to two mediocre movie experiences. I think I know where you're going. I'm going to be a little bit different. I still would have Dark Phoenix tentatively a notch ahead of Last Stand if I'm ranking them. Like, it's by the closest of margins.
Yeah,
I would rank Dark Phoenix a little bit ahead of Last Stand. But I will acknowledge also that the best parts of Last Stand are better than the best parts of Dark Phoenix.
Yeah, that's kind of where I'm at with it as well. It's extremely close for me. I think Dark Phoenix is a more competently made movie. Like, it's a tighter narrative. It has a focus. You can disagree with how they go about executing that focus and that vision, but there's no doubt that they're there to tell one story. And by and large, I think it's more, like I said, competently made. However, you also can't escape the fact that it's pretty damn boring. Like, it drags on. Dark Phoenix is 8 minutes longer than X-Men The Last Stand. An hour 53 compared to an hour 45. And yet, it feels like it's 2.5 hours long.
Yeah, I agree with that. It felt much longer.
It is a movie where you feel the length. And so, when all things are equal, if you're putting a gun to my head and making me choose which one of these would I rather watch, I would rather watch the thing that feels like it's over faster than it should be rather than the thing that just never feels like it's going to end. And so, while I think Dark Phoenix is, again, better made, I think I would kind of rather watch this.
And that's fair. You know, I would probably rather watch Dark Phoenix because it doesn't inspire rage in me like this movie does, but I can also acknowledge that Last Stand is faster paced, and it's high points, while I would say that Dark Phoenix is more consistent.
Yes.
I would say that the high points of Last Stand are better. The Wolverine.
I forgot Psylocke was even in this movie.
Psylocke is in this movie?
Yes, apparently.
Oh my. Not any version of Psylocke that we would ever recognize, I don't think.
She's got purple hair, and she's Asian, so I'm assuming
it's Psylocke. Yeah, probably. Does she work for Magneto?
Yes.
Ah.
This guy with his lame blowfish powers is going to kill her with the needles.
Ah, yes. He hugs her, and then... Yeah. Ugh. Anyway. So... What are your thoughts on this movie, folks? Assuming that this recording works and you ever hear this, tweet us at gphillips8652, at nickduke87. Let us know your thoughts on The Last Stand. If you've seen Dark Phoenix, let us know your thoughts on how that compares to The Last Stand. Do you think one of them is much better than the other one? One of them is much worse than the other one? Let us know. Also, the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page. You can find us there. Anyway, there's all kinds of places you can find us. We're going to take a break and make sure that this works.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation Pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome back to the most must-listen podcast in
Didn't work. Nice try, though. I see what you're going for. The theory behind it was solid, but the execution was poor.
Well, sometimes you try to execute the plays that are called, and quite frankly, Conrad, sometimes it just doesn't work.
That's true.
Sometimes the creative just doesn't work.
Sometimes the damn Skype recorder doesn't work, as we found out this week.
Yes.
Somehow, though, we have arrived here in the back half.
Now, what would be funny, Nick, is if we do this back half of the show and it doesn't record.
Well, then the people will just listen to the first half, and that'll keep the streak alive, and we'll move on with our lives because it's just not that important.
It's really not. But you know, one thing that is important is our weekly look at the news and notes in the world of comics, Nick. That weekly segment that the folks at the airport have pulled me aside to talk to me about. It's a segment known the world over as the Rundown.
Oh, Charles, welcome to the Rundown.
Well, you know, one of the stories we've been talking about has been the constant and rampant discussion about the DC Universe app and its status in relation to the Warner Media app that is planned to be launched later on. And, you know, we talked about Swamp Thing being a potential victim of that. Well, a DC Universe rep went on their forums and commented on this. He said that they cannot reveal the reasons why the series was canceled. However, he says that anything indicating that the DC Universe app is in question is false rumors and speculation, and that none of the other original series have been affected by the Swamp Thing decision. So, Nick, certainly there's not much to tell from this story, because what else would this person say?
Absolutely. I mean, like, you know, do I necessarily believe that DC Universe is in danger of going away? No. Do I necessarily believe that because some rep came out and said that was the case? No. Like, this is this guy's job. He's employed by DC. He's going to tell him whatever he's told to tell him. And generally speaking, when things like this are out there, going through the forums and deleting posts where people are daring to speculate on it isn't typically the standpoint that someone would take where, you know, where they actually want you to know that there's nothing going on. So
it's certainly not a good way to dissuade speculation.
Right, exactly. So,
And for the record, like, you're kind of damned if you do and damned if you don't from a PR perspective, because people are going to believe whatever rumors are out there anyway.
Yeah.
And so you're kind of screwed in a manner of speaking, because
I think the denial would have been fine. It's the deleting of the post.
The deleting of the post comes
off as a little like, oh, well, that's weird.
Sure.
Yeah, like I said, I don't necessarily believe that DC Universe is in danger of going away. I think there are some legitimate concerns as it relates to, like, you know, large corporations are often obsessed, as we know, with that elusive term, synergy. And so I kind of do wonder what the synergistic approach will be.
And can I ask you something, Conrad? What the hell is synergy? What the hell does it mean? At the end of the day, I mean, I know it's a buzzword. I know it's about making sure your properties are working together. But what the hell does that mean at the end of the day?
Well, in this case, I don't know. But in any event, I don't buy that DC Universe is going away. But I also don't buy this overly, you know, optimistic and positive spin from DC either. Mm-hmm. As with most things, the truth likely lies somewhere in the middle.
Well, one thing that has been decided in the favor of comic book fans is Why the Last Man and the adaptation called Why that is being planned for the FX network. We reported on our show just recently that the show seemed to be hitting an iceberg of sorts in the form of its showrunners leaving. Well, it turns out that FX did not throw in the towel on this show, because Animal Kingdom's Eliza Clark has been hired as the replacement showrunner on Why, and she is a longtime fan of the series. She consumed it apparently the same way that we did, where we and she read all the graphic novels, the trade collections, about a decade ago, and became a huge fan of it, and is looking forward to bringing this show to television. So, pretty nice sigh of relief was breathed by me on this one, Nick. I'm excited about this. I think Y is an ideal target for a TV show.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised, honestly, because so much time had passed between the announcement that the previous showrunner was leaving and this announcement that it felt like, God, how long can you keep cast and crew just kind of standing around waiting for a new showrunner? And yet, they were able to pull it together. So here's hoping that this person will come in and just do what we've wanted all along, which is a straight adaptation of the comic. Doesn't need any added modern context. Doesn't need any added political commentary. There's plenty of that already. Just make the show like the book.
And that's not all. I agree completely. And that's not all the good news for DC fans or for fans of comic books in general, because this fall, some classic characters are about to be Snyderized! Nick?
Mm-mm.
You're not going to do it?
I'm not a singer. You know this.
Here's a story about two brothers named Rick and Scott. And, okay. Well, Scott Snyder, who does not have a brother Rick, as far as I know.
But what if he did?
He'd be a good man. Mm-hmm. I think we all know that. Is bringing the Justice Society of America back to the DC Universe. This classic World War II era super team will return in the pages of Snyder's Justice League comic later this year. And apparently it is going to not necessarily directly tie into the events of Doomsday Clock, but will reflect their return in the pages of Doomsday Clock. So There was a more in-depth interview that Snyder did later in the week about this topic, and apparently some of his comments were edited after the fact for reasons unknown. And so we will see what this has to do with Doomsday Clock when the time comes. But certainly, I think the Justice Society's presence has been missing in the DCU for a long time. It was one of the things that we were all excited about back when Rebirth first started, back when Rebirth was still a thing. And so good for DC to bring these characters back. I know Snyder says he has plans for all of them, so should be an interesting take on these classic heroes.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing what the take is. You know, the Justice Society is one of those things, as you mentioned, we've been waiting for a long time, and now with Doomsday Clock finally nearing its end, it has paved the way for their return and the return of another superhero team, right, Greg?
That's correct, because the Legion of Superheroes is being brought back under the pen of one Brian Michael Bendis, the ubiquitous Brian Michael Bendis. This is a team that Nick and I don't know the first thing about.
No. And we get yelled at online for it.
And we have been taken to task for it. Some would say we've been abused for it. Some would say that we've been victimized. Some would say that we've been left with blood and sweat and urine around us as a result of our lack of knowledge or interest in the Legion of Superheroes. But nonetheless, a lot of people are fired up about this return. And these classic heroes, the Legion, will be returning full force this September, first with a two-part prelude special, followed by an ongoing series by Brian Michael Bendis. How does he find time to write all these comics, Nick? It's amazing. This guy is writing everything right now and continuing to introduce new concepts that I'm sure he's excited to work with within the DC universe.
Yeah, got his own imprint at DC where he's writing, I believe, Young Justice and Naomi, I know. I believe he might be writing Wonder Twins, or maybe somebody else is. But either way, he's overseeing all those titles, plus doing Superman and Action Comics and creator-owned stuff. And now, Event Leviathan with the current event in DC Comics. And then adding Legion of Superheroes this fall. So Bendis, as he's done for many years, going to stay busy.
Indeed he is. And certainly very exciting news for a lot of people. I'm happy for all of our friends that are happy about the Legion coming back into the mainstream continuity. And also, we've got our old boy Wally West. He's gone through a bit of a harsh time recently, what with murdering a bunch of people and then covering it up and blaming it on other heroes.
That sure sounds like a real Wally West thing to do.
It does. I mean, you know, you wake up, you decide, hey, this sounds like something I'm going to do right now. It does sound like something that he
Are you suggesting that early one morning while making the rounds, he took a shot of cocaine and he shot all his friends down?
Perhaps so. Perhaps so, Nick. Perhaps I am suggesting that. Perhaps I'm also suggesting that he's got an 8-foot bed that never has to be made.
Oh! Oh my God, it's approaching, Greg. We're getting closer and closer by the day for the season of the Vern.
It's true. The season of the Vern.
Mm-hmm.
The Wallace, well, he's still retired, right?
Thank God, yes. But I mean, it will forever be his season.
That's
How can
true.
You see something big happen and not let out a ha
ha? Whispering Bill Anderson. Well, no, what we're talking about here is old Wally West. He is getting a series called Flash Forward. Actually, it's a limited series called Flash Forward that will follow his quest for redemption following the events of Heroes in Crisis. And this series is going to be written by Scott Lobdell and drawn by Brett Booth.
Welp.
Exactly. Now, I understand that Scott Lobdell has done good work on Red Hood and whatever the book's called now, Red Hood and the Outlaws, and has done fine work on that, but his DC work on the whole has not been great, and I am not a fan of Brett Booth. I decided that a long time ago. Nothing against him personally. His style of art just does not mesh with me at all. And what's unfortunate is that I've seen the cover of Flash Forward number one, and this is a great cover, and the cover is by Doc Shaner, who will not be doing the interiors, so that's kind of a bummer as well. But, Nick, your thoughts on Wally's next, finally getting a series where he looks for redemption for murdering and trying to erase his crime.
I have no thoughts on this. I didn't read Heroes in Crisis. Probably won't read Heroes in Crisis, honestly. And I'm not a massive Wally West fan, but I can say I genuinely hope that those Wally West fans who are legitimately, and deservedly so, by the way, angry about what their favorite character has undergone, I hope this series provides a bit of closure on that.
Yes, agreed. Agreed completely. On all counts. Well, one of our favorite artists here at Hard Traveling Fanboys in recent years has been Skip John Sajic.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just been one of our favorites. We loved his work on Aquaman. Thought he was a great fit for that book. Well, he is coming back to DC to do some more work for him. And he has created a Black Label title that is going to be a reimagining of the origins of Harley Quinn and her relationship with the Joker. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be called Harleen. Mm-hmm. And will follow Dr. Harleen Quinzel as her treatment, well, I lost track of my sentence here that I was reading. As her treatment of a crazed animal, the sentence didn't make sense to me, but now I get it. Of a crazed animal, the Joker turns into a love affair gone wrong. Now, Nick, I think this is an intriguing premise. Mm-hmm. It's going to present a new side of Harley and the artwork is going to be magnificent.
Absolutely. And anything, if you follow Mr. Sajic on the Twitter machine, you know that he has, he's drawn provocative imagery in the past. And I would.
Okay, JR.
You know.
He's drawn some, quite frankly, some provocative images in the past.
I'm just saying. Just saying there's some things about it. And I would expect this will probably have some provocative imagery in it.
Certainly there are some young men in the audience, and some perhaps young women, primarily young, primarily defiant. Defiant. Everyone's defiant. Anyway, this book's going to be great, I'm sure. It looks good. I don't know. Oh, I don't know if he can write. That's the other thing. I don't know if...
Yeah, that'll be the interesting thing.
But we'll see.
But his art is so damn good that it almost doesn't matter. Good. You know?
Real good. Now, the final item that we have for you this week is one that I know is close to Nick's cold, cold heart.
Oh, this is where the power lies, sir.
You know, right here is where the power lies, dude. Jason Aaron and Esad Ribic.
Yes.
Are sold. Reuniting for King Thor. Now, this, of course, was the creative team behind the critically acclaimed and HTF acclaimed Thor God of Thunder. They will do a 4-issue King Thor limited series that will purportedly feature the final battle between Thor and Loki as they clash in the future for the final time. And Loki is bringing a new weapon, the Necro Sword, once wielded by the God Butcher in God of Thunder. So, Nick, I got to be honest, even as someone that hasn't followed Thor for many years, this sounds awesome.
In so many ways, not just the concept of the story, which is amazing, especially if you view it in the context of the larger Jason Aaron Thor run that's been going on for so long, but also just the thematic ideas behind the idea of the story bringing his run full circle in terms of having the Necro Sword come back into play, have this be like his take on the last confrontation between Thor and Loki, and also ending his run with the same creative partner that he began it with, Esad Ribic, and calling back to this flash-forward story that we have seen play out over the many years. I'm pumped for this, man. I am convinced this is going to kind of be a much more melancholy-like version of that Geoff Johns epilogue from Green Lantern 20, where this is going to be Jason Aaron's, like, you know, if I never got to write the characters again and I could pick an ending for them, he's going to give us what his ending for these characters would be. And I think that's awesome. Can't wait.
Yep. Looking forward to it. That's a great step by Marvel. And the one thing that you can be sure of is that if one of these two companies hypes up a big event, it's going to deliver.
Oh, and that's a tease for next week's show if there ever was one.
Absolutely. That's intentionally why I did it. In all seriousness, this Jason Aaron story is, I'm sure, going to be great. Well, that's the end of the rundown. We're not doing reading and watching this week because we ain't read nothing or watched nothing. Right, Nick?
Except for Last Stand 17 times.
Yes. God almighty. I think I'm just going to make it part of my daily routine now. Just put it on.
Wake up.
Every day.
Well, you can do that. You can multitask. You know, you can brush your teeth and watch Last Stand, or you can brush your teeth and tie your shoes and watch Last Stand. And by that, I mean stick a toothbrush in your mouth, tie your shoes, and claim you're brushing your teeth while you do it.
I actually can do that because I have an electric toothbrush now.
There you go.
So it does all the brushing for me. But I don't think that's how it works. But nonetheless, we are not doing reading and watching. Even if we had it, we wouldn't do it this week. We're desperately out of cares.
We're sick of it, damn it. We're sick of all of it.
That's it. You're exactly right. And much like existential Earl Hebner, there is a grandfather clock on the wall, but it's sort of malfunctioning. Here is the wrestling minute. Boy, there's a bunch of stuff going on in wrestling, huh?
Yep, wrestling. It's doing things. There are things happening. There was a pretty good Raw.
Yeah.
SmackDown that you said was all right.
Yeah, it was fine. Rare week where Raw was better than SmackDown. AEW exists. We'll be going to AEW in about a month's time.
That'll be fun.
And that'll be good. And I'm going to see, actually, this is a good one. Next Friday night, I'm going to see Mick Foley.
Oh, yeah.
Here in Dothan, Alabama. And I'm looking forward to that. I love the Micker. I first met him when I was 16 years old, and he did a book signing at Books A Million for his first book. And I went there and stood in line for several hours and ended up getting his autograph on that book. And I've always remembered that meeting. So looking forward to seeing Mick one more time and hearing him tell some stories.
Absolutely. Should be fun.
Well, and that's it for the rundown, folks.
The wrestling minute, you mean?
I mean the wrestling minute and the rundown. Both of them. Why not? Nick, what can you tell me about Mr. Jim Ross's appearance this week on the show?
I can tell you a lot about Mr. Jim Ross's appearance on the show. For no reason whatsoever. No discernible reason. I was thinking of this, of a little ditty from earlier, in the 1990s, a local country song that was popular, you know, back then, and I have since found out it was apparently a redo, a cover of a song from the 70s, actually. But we best know it, Greg. You and I best know it, thanks to one Sammy Kershaw, and he sang this little song about a romance between people who don't have any damn money. And, I don't know, just seemed appropriate. So, WWE Hall of Famer, good old JR Jim Ross. Why don't you take it away?
All right. Well, let's see. Mr. Ross, let's see if we can get you in here and get your thoughts on this situation.
Well, thank you very much, Conrad. I appreciate you bringing me on. Meet Sammy Kershaw. Now, if I were to start singing this song, it might sound something like this. Sitting in a tiny table in a ritzy restaurant, she was staring at her coffee cup. He was trying to keep his courage up by applying booze. Now, talk was small when they talked and all, and they both knew what they wanted. And what they wanted was to see Austin on top. They wanted to see the Rattlesnake work with individuals that can make the Rattlesnake some money. They didn't want to see the Rattlesnake work with Jeff Jarrett. They didn't want to see the Rattlesnake work with Owen Hart. They wanted to see the Rattlesnake wrestle the Undertaker, the conscience of the WWE, I always called him, even before it was the WWE. They wanted to see Austin wrestle the Undertaker no fewer than 55 times. There was no need to talk about it. They didn't have to talk about the spots, folks. They did not need to meet 4 hours before the event to plan out every single thing they were going to do. They called it in the ring. They were old enough to scope it out, to read the audience, to feel what the audience was feeling, and keep it loose. She said, "You don't look like my type, but I guess that you'll do. Oh, that's real cute. Third-rate romance, low-rent rendezvous. And he said, I'll even tell you that I love your ass if you want me to. Third-rate romance, low-rent rendezvous. I apologize, folks. That didn't happen to J.R. very often. When they left the bar, they got in his car and they drove away. They drove to the family inn. He didn't even have to pretend. She didn't know what for. Anyway, he went to the desk and made his request while she waited outside. Then she came back with the key. Now, what was the key? It was probably one of the two creators. And I fucked that line up, but I'm going to say it again anyway. It was probably one of the two C's, cash or creative. In this case, it was creative. She said, give it to me. Oh, yeah, give it to me. And I'll unlock the door. She kept saying, I've really never done this kind of thing before. Have you? Third-rate romance, low-rate rendezvous. And much like Bret Hart said to Steve Austin before the WrestleMania 13 encounter, he said, yes, I have done this, but only a time or two, referring to cutting his opponent in the forehead. Third-rate romance, low-rent rendezvous. Third-rate romance, low-rent rendezvous. You got to speak in sound bites.